Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is post-production mixer Michael Perricone. But first of all, this has been a really busy week in the music business. There's so much going on. And let's talk about a couple of things. The first one is Apple Music is changing. There's been a lot of criticism about Apple Music over the last year since it's been launched, and Apple is finally taking heed. So the first thing is, it really needs a facelift, and it looks like it's going to be getting it and getting it soon. Many people have complained about the user interface. Many have complained about the look and the feel. And as with all criticism, some of it is probably true and some of it isn't. But there's a whole bunch of things that are wrong with it. And to Apple's credit, they're trying to get it right. One of the controversies that's ongoing right now is the fact that people are losing their personal music. This is the music that they own that's been loaded into iTunes, has been disappearing. And if you're an artist, that's especially bad because it could be your personal mixes, for instance, that suddenly disappear, or they're only available in AAC and not WAV format. Not the final mixes, high-res mixes, in other words. So that's a really bad thing. Many have been going back and forth on that, saying that's user error. But if it is user error, really, that, again, says something about the interface not being correct. If you can't figure out how to protect the music that you own, there's something wrong there. So Apple is actually going to fix everything. That's a really good thing. And it looks like by the end of June, we should see that. Another thing that just happened is Apple has introduced a $4.99 per month student plan. This is a good idea because it's really what's led to Spotify's growth. And what I like to tell people is whenever I go to colleges and give a talk, first thing I ask is, okay, who's on Spotify, Apple Music, et cetera, just to get a feel. And the difference between last year and this year with Spotify is amazing, where last year you had a few hands go up in a crowd of maybe 50, now maybe 80% or more are Spotify subscribers. And the reason why, of course, is the fact that there's a $4.99 plan. So this is a good idea that Apple is doing it, and expect to see their subscriber rates go up substantially as a result. If you listen to this podcast or if you read any of my blogs, you know that I'm a big proponent of virtual reality, and it's going to be the future, especially for audio, because while we're making leaps and bounds, jumps ahead on the visual side, the audio is still really lagging and no one's paying a lot of attention. So I see that as a market niche that needs to be filled. So for those of you out there that really want to get into something new and something that's going to expand quickly, VR is the way to go. Many people have said that the concert experience for VR may be one of the ultimate displays of the technology. So for instance, instead of going to a live concert, you're watching it on a VR headset, and it gives you the feeling that you have the best seat in the house. And again, you can look up and see the artist on the stage. You can look around. You can see all the people. You look behind you. You can see, you know, everything in the concert. So everyone feels that this is going to be a big money generator in the future, as well as a leap ahead in terms of an extra revenue stream for the artists as well. The good part about this is it's not way in the future. We're going to see it this summer. The reason why we know this is a company called NextVR has teamed with Live Nation. They've announced that they're going to do a few concerts this summer in VR, broadcast it in VR, and then next year, 2017, they're going to roll it out big time. So that should be interesting to see what happens. So we should be seeing some of that coming on pretty soon. It's going to be available through Oculus Home, and it's especially available for the Samsung Gear VR headset, although they say they're going to roll it out to all the other headsets as well. They're not the only company, though. Universal Music Group and iHeartRadio has already announced that they're also planning to do the same thing. They're going to have some concerts broadcast in VR this year, and later in the year, they're going to begin to roll out a full schedule of VR concert broadcasts. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Brand Your Music Crash Course, as well as my 101 Mixing Tricks program and other online video courses. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Some other news this week in the business world of musical instruments and audio. Behringer announced that it was going to lay off a bunch of people. Now, Behringer was once upon a time known as a company that basically copied other companies' designs and then had them made cheaply in China and then turned out the same product basically for a whole lot less money. They've grown into a global conglomerate, however, and along the way bought some big-time brands, high-end brands like Midas and Clark Technique and Turbo Sound, and most recently the TC Group, which owns TC Electronic and Tannoy, among other companies. And the company just announced that it was going to move Tannoy from Scotland, where it's been for 35 years. This is the manufacturing now. And they're going to move it to China, to Behringer City. Behringer basically has a whole manufacturing city in China, and I could see why they'd want to move everything there. The fact of the matter is you got 70 people that are highly skilled workers in Scotland that are going to be out of business, and these are people that have been building speakers, building Tannoys for a long, long time. So that's the corporate world we live in, and not only do we see it on big brands that we're used to buying, but we also see it in our industry as well. Another example of that same mentality is Avid this week announced that it was hiring 250 new people. The problem is they're laying off all the people in the U.S. and they're replacing them with workers that are cheaper overseas. So for instance, Avid's hardware design will now be done in Taiwan. Its customer service will be done in the Philippines, and all the R&D will be done in Poland. In the press release, it was pretty interesting. They said they're moving to a small town in Poland because of its close proximity to technological universities. And, you know, it makes you wonder, some of the best universities are based in the United States. And once again, this really has nothing to do with the customer, unfortunately. Avid stock is pretty much at an all-time low. So everything that it's doing is trying to please Wall Street. Not only that, it looks like they're going to have a really bad earnings call, which comes up next week. And you can tell it's going to be bad because their CFO is stepping down. So that's usually an indication when top executive heads roll that there's something bad about to happen or has just happened. So we're seeing this major reorganization by Avid. And again, this has nothing to do with users, and there's no upside for the user in this. So right now, if you call Avid, at least you're getting people in the United States that have worked on the product, that have worked with the company, that know the product. And pretty soon, when you call in to customer service, you're going to get people that are just coming up to speed on it, and there's no industrial knowledge there. It makes you wonder what the long-term prognosis is for Avid doing this, because certainly this is a band-aid and it's not going to help them in terms of keeping their users. So very, very bad precedent. Once again, the best thing that could happen is that Avid will spin off Pro Tools, and a company that maybe can do something a lot more with it will take it over, and let's all keep our fingers crossed on that one. My guest today is musician, screenwriter, and post-engineer Michael Perricone. Michael has worked on dozens of television shows, documentaries, and movies as a re-recording mixer. Not only that, he's a recording artist who performs all over the world as well. Michael was also the re-recording mixer for a number of music shows and has mixed projects with The Pretenders, Heart, Cyndi Lauper, and Lynyrd Skynyrd, among many, many others. I spoke with Michael via Skype from his home in Los Angeles. It's hard to wear multiple hats where you're a studio owner and an operator at the same time.
Right,
and
right.
You've done that a lot through your career.
Yeah, but there are times when it's easier than other times. If you have a really good team, then it can work. I owned Interlock with James Vandel for 17 years, and that worked well. And for the most part, I was mixing all during that time. There were a few years where I stopped mixing. But now, especially with feature films, it's a very different gestalt. It's because it's basically 9 to 7 union type hours, and it's very focused. And sometimes the projects are so intense. Like I finished this film called The Perfect Match about a month ago, and it was in theaters two weeks ago.
Wow.
So it just was so fast. Yeah, as a matter of fact, this past Friday, it was this past weekend, it was the second weekend in the top 10. So yes, it's a crazy time for independent films.
Well, actually, that's a good place to start. Since you've done both, you've done post and you've done a lot of music, what would you say would be the differences?
Well, one of the big differences is that post is a very specific schedule. It's very 9 to 7. Where, of course, music, especially back in the 80s, when I'd go into the studio at 4 o'clock and come out, and maybe it was daylight, maybe it was not, when I come out of the studio. A lot of all-nighters back in the 80s. But it's much more dependable as far as schedule. I enjoy bringing together all the different elements. With music, you're bringing in all the different instruments into a mix and recording them. With films, you're bringing together all the different elements, the sound effects, the foley, the backgrounds, all the dialogue and the music, and bringing that together to the final mix. And it's fun to bring, it's a similar process, but it's a little more organized and a higher level of professionalism.
And in terms of the differences between, because I know you've done both. You've done a lot of television and you've done movies as well. What's the difference there?
Well, television, a lot of the television that I did, I did some movies of the week, but I did a lot of reality television. And that is very fast. That comes in, we'll get the project turned over in the morning. If it's a half-hour show, a day and a half later, it's done, and we're laying it back or sending off files to be laid back to the final picture. Whereas a movie, we have 6 weeks in general to work on it. They'll turn it over. Our sound effects crew will start designing the sound effects and sound design. Foley will start recording footsteps and props. And the musician, of course, the composers will be off writing music. And the dialogue editor will start cutting the dialogue, and we'll start planning what the ADR is going to be, what actors need to come in. I just finished a film called London Town, and all the actors were in London, were in England, various parts of England. And so it was all done via Skype, Source Connect. So Source Connect works really, really well, except for we get a notice saying, okay, the session's going to be at 1 p.m. in the afternoon, London time. Which means I have to come down to the studio at 5 in the morning to log in and supervise the ADR. But I love the process. It's very creative, and having been a screenwriter and loving movies, it's a chance to really get really detailed. So films are much more detailed than television shows.
Well, you must be really one of the few who, and maybe the only one, who's been a writer, a screenwriter, as well as being a mixer. I mean, that doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, I think it's a very small list. I always approach my mix as a storyteller. What are we trying to convey? So when I'm emphasizing various different things in the mix, I'm emphasizing those things from a story standpoint. And especially if I'm supervising the film also, I will point out a lot of things to the creative team and the director and stuff, saying, you know, this is the story point here, right? This is what's happening. Well, maybe we should do this, or maybe you should just have them say something here. And I try not to put words in their mouth because they don't like that. But just pointing to the general idea, hey, what if you did said something about here? Or maybe if the group Walla has some reference to something. So I get to inject little story points into the process, as well as with sound effects. Well, there might be a scene. Well, we should motivate him doing something by a sound here. And most of the time they agree.
That's pretty cool. I mean, that's another level of creativity.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's one of the reasons I still love mixing. As a matter of fact, when I sold the studio, some of my friends are saying, so you're going to retire now? No, I'm not going to retire, because why would I want to quit doing something I like so much?
Yeah. And actually, you know, that's reasonable hours if you're doing 9 to 7. If you're doing, of course, on a movie, towards the end, I know that kind of goes out the window, doesn't it?
Not that much. Not that much. They might add days. Very rarely do we go into overtime. So it's because overtime is expensive in movies. It's very, very strictly enforced too. So it's better to buy another day and come in the next day than to go into heavy duty overtime.
How long have you been in the union?
Well, it's kind of funny. I got in the union in 1977, but then I was out of the union until about 2 years ago. I was doing a couple film projects where I needed to reactivate my union membership. So, but I've stumbled along my original Y1 card from way back when it wasn't even the same union local. They changed locals since then. Mm-hmm. There used to be 695 sound mixers, but now they've lumped all the re-recording mixers together with the editors, and it's now the Editors Guild Local 700.
Was that difficult to reactivate?
Well, it was potentially expensive, but I negotiated about a 25%, a 75% discount. But no, it was not difficult. It was just I actually had to call all the way to New York. I just kept calling up the chain until I got to someone high up, because they wanted to slap me with a lot of late fees.
Oh, yeah, 20 years worth, 30 years worth, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
So that was potentially pretty expensive, but no, it turned out to be okay, and I made enough. I made more on the movie than the reinitiation fee was, so I was okay.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So now working for SmartPost, which is a union company, everything that I do is under a union. Under the watchful eye of the union. SmartPost is primarily a television company, and it's great working with them because I bring a much more film viewpoint to things.
Yeah, definitely. Let's go back to when you were mixing reality television.
Mm-hmm. And I still do. There's one show that I've kept. It's called Cops.
Yeah, that's just where I was going.
I was about to go over there to take a look at how season 29 is shaping up, because we're about to start that. Season 29 of Cops.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it's like a family. We've all been doing it together for so long now. So I've kept that. And a lot of times I'll mix the films during the week and come in on Saturday and do the Cops episode, that week's Cops episode.
You wouldn't think there'd be much to do on that in terms of audio. Is there a lot of elements?
Well, no, there are very few elements, but the problem is it's location stuff that's captured completely on the fly. And these guys are amazing, the camera work that they do, because they'll be driving along, they'll get a car, or they'll see a car speed off, then they'll just jump into a chase, maybe barrel out of the car, it turns into a foot chase. Cameraman and the boom guy are right there with them running along. But there's a lot of cleanup to be done. So basically, we only get four mics. They only have a stereo camera mic, a boom mic, and then a lav on the principal officer. So it's sifting through and picking whichever one carries the information, because a lot of times they'll be interviewing the perpetrator in front of a police car with the engine running on the side of a busy freeway.
Hmm.
So it's digging out, and really it's a lot more work than you might think to dig out what the person is saying, especially if it's some guy that's on meth or really drunk and really barely talking at all, whispering. So the sounds around him are four times as loud as the dialogue. So that's the difficult part. But the rest of it is, it's very, of course, the show is completely verite. We don't sweeten it. There's no music during it. So it's all about just getting all the levels to the right level and getting every word of dialogue audible. And it's great because every single episode, one of the editors will say, oh, I never heard that before. And something that the perpetrator said, I never heard him say that, because it was buried in the murk.
Do you have a secret for doing that?
A combination. My dialogue chain, I run through the Waves WNS, and I also use a lot of Isotope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a question of EQ, and the worst part is if it's in a crowded room with a lot of people talking. But I also use a lot of, I've used FabFilter as my notch filter, which I like very much.
Yeah.
I've got a setting that I've created that's like 10 frequencies of notches, and I can really quickly identify the various different ranges. Cars, when they're sitting against the car with the engine running, it's usually there are two primary frequencies that are interfering with the dialogue, and so I can notch those right out. And so between that and the WNS, which is a noise filter, similar, it's a dynamic noise filter, similar to an old Cat 43 or Cat 430 system that Dolby used to make.
Yeah. That's cool. So I guess then that chain would be much different than if you're doing a movie.
Well, no, actually, it's the same dialogue chain. It's just I have to work a little harder and push it a little farther.
Okay.
Because in a movie, I may barely, I'll have the W and S in the dialogue chain, but I'll maybe notch out a little lower mid for some air conditioning noise or something, but it'll just be a couple dB, whereas it's not drastic like I will have to do with the cops. But yes, it's the exact same dialogue chain that I use for features. And I still do it old school. A lot of people keep it all dynamic, but I actually print a dialogue pre-dub track, and usually several of them, so that I can have different angles. If it's a feature and I know that I might want to pan something or affect one dialogue differently, I'll put it on a separate pre-dub track, and I'll record those that way. So when I go into the mix, it's much easier to pan, and I can focus on all the other elements that are going on.
Yeah, you don't have to use as much automation then.
The automation is I'll make the original dialogue tracks inactive and just use the pre-dub tracks.
Yeah.
But fortunately, running the HDX cards, I've yet to run into a problem where I've run out of automation or processing power with the Pro Tools. I've run Pro Tools 11. I have Pro Tools 12 on one of my systems here, but for the most part, I still run 11. There are a couple things that bother me in 12. But so 11 works great. 11 is fantastic. Pro Tools 11 has been really a fantastic tool.
How many tracks do you normally have when you're doing a movie?
It depends. The Morgan Freeman, Clive Owen film I did, I was like 300 people fighting with swords and axes. So it was probably about 450 tracks.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Foley, a lot of sound effects. A basic kind of a like Perfect Match, the one that's in theaters right now, probably that was about 150 tracks, and a lot of those are music stems, because the music will come in either as stereo, or this particular film came in as surround stems, so maybe six track surround stems times two, because there will be an A set and a B set of music stems in case there's an overlap. So that alone, six times, that's 36, that's 72 tracks right there just for the score, plus some source music tracks. So easily I might have had 85 tracks for music.
Yeah.
So it just gets wide really quickly.
And what are you mixing on now?
Well, primarily Pro Tools. Well, it's all Pro Tools, but primarily three systems. We'll have one system that'll have all the dialogue, the music, and the live group, ADR group wallet that we've recorded on one system. And then another system will have the sound effects, the sound design, all the background ambiences, and the Foley. And then a third system will carry the picture, and then that'll be our recorder. So we'll record all the different elements to the center machine, what we call our stem recorder.
Hmm. What's controlling it? Do you have an S6 or something that you're using?
Well, I have an S6 in one of the rooms, but on our big feature stage, we have two D commands, the Icon, Icon D commands.
Right.
So, and we're running Pro Tools 11 on all those systems. And so the satellite works great. Just it runs like one machine, all three of them together. We can handle 950 tracks in that room.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you've come a long way since I can remember when you first started.
We started Lotus Post 6 years ago, 2009, and then way before that was Interlock.
Yeah.
That was, I sold that in 2002.
I remember Interlock because I worked there a few times. The first room on the left as you walked in, I remember specifically, and I can't remember what I did in there, but I just remember being in there. But that was a cool place, and that was a great location, downtown Hollywood.
Yep, right next to the Cat and Fiddle. Oh, actually, I guess the Cat and Fiddle pub is not there anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately.
That was a total landmark.
Yeah
so it was great being there. We actually started, when we started Interlock in 1985, we started in the United Western building. So that was wild to be, and then at that point in time, there was Ocean Way had one of the rooms there. So we were doing our combination. We started Interlock to do music production, Jim Mandel and I. But I happened to mention when we were forming it, well, I've got this television series that they want me to do the post on. So looks like we'll be doing that. Before long, we were doing about 95% post-production and 5% music. But it helped, it definitely helped pay the bills.
Okay.
Then we moved to Crossroads of the World. And that's another landmark in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So we were there until 1995 when we moved to the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce building. And that's one that was at 6520 Sunset, right by where the Cat and Fiddle Pub used to be.
Yeah.
And that building had so much vibe to it. It was very cool.
Yeah, definitely. I was looking at your credits, and I noticed that you've done a lot of concert television shows.
Surround.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Cheap Trick, ZZ Top, Heart, Lynyrd Skynyrd. And then I realized, you know, I've seen all of these. They're great. Did an awesome job. How did that happen? How did you get those?
Well, when I sold Interlock, I put a room together, and a lot of the people that I'd worked with in the music realm were coming to me, so I put a room together in conjunction with a company called Threshold Sound, and so they were doing a lot of music recording. They had a big old, an old Neve console and everything, so they were doing the stereo mixes, and they needed somebody who understood surround to do the surround mixes of these. So I would do the surround mixes, and on some of them I'd do the full surround mix of the songs. Other times I'd get some stems on, the Ben Harper. The Ben Harper one, I got a whole bunch of stereo stems that I had to just create a surround mix out of. And so it's a little bit, it's half mixing, half mastering for surround, and then syncing everything to picture. So that was partly due to the fact that I was right next to a major music mixing facility.
Mm, yeah.
So,
well, I did a lot of that myself for a while, but you know, I saw Cheap Trick, and there's one Cheap Trick project that came in that I never did do, but it wasn't my fault. It came in on this old Agfa tape, this old red Agfa. So multi-track, right?
Two inch,
yeah. And I put it on the machine to rewind it, and the tape exploded into a billion pieces.
Ugh.
And luckily, it was a safety copy, but they pulled the project anyway. I never got it, and I really like Cheap Trick, so I was kind of bummed about that. But, you know, so it goes.
That Cheap Trick show was amazing. They did Sgt. Pepper, a live concert of Sgt. Pepper in its entirety. The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album.
Yeah.
I had no idea the level of musicianship of these guys. They pulled it off amazing. I was so impressed with all the players of the Cheap Trick guys, how they could pull it off, because it's a very intricate, all this intricate musicianship. Because George Martin, of course, created all these overdubs and things. So they pulled it off amazingly. And so I learned a lot about Cheap Trick on that project.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, of course, you know, they were a cover band for years in the Midwest there, so I think that was, that's where you got your chops together once upon a time.
Yeah.
No longer.
Doing cover band.
Yeah.
Well, that was me in high school playing in cover bands.
Yeah, me too, definitely. Tell me about writing for Star Trek. How did that happen?
Well, being in post-production, I got tired of being at the tail end of the whole process, because audio is when everybody's burnt out and tired of the project, and they just want to get it done. So I wanted to get on the beginning of the end of the process. I used to write stories, short stories in high school, in between playing in rock bands. So I just started writing this thing, and I showed it to a friend of mine who's also a budding writer. And he said, well, that's really good. So we kind of worked together on finishing that project. And it was a pilot script for a cool TV series, which was a show about people on Titan, the largest moon of Saturn. And it was this quirky kind of northern exposure sort of show. And we finished that. We sent it out to 50 agents and managers, and two of them actually read it, and both of them wanted to sign us. So they started sending it around, and we actually got invited to go pitch at Star Trek. So we pitched four different story ideas, and and that was for the Voyager series, and they said, you know, we really like the guys' ideas. They won't work for what we're doing now, but how's about developing this idea and writing this? So we ended up coming back with our take on a story of theirs, and they liked it, and they said, okay, well, come in Monday for story break. So we ended up writing this script, which was our first one, which was also nominated for a Saturn Award and a Sci-Fi Universe Award. So they invited us to keep coming and pitching more stories. And we came back 10 more times, and each time we'd pitch three or four stories. And they all, out of all that, they bought one other story. So I really only wrote for Star Trek twice. Out of pitching 36 stories, we sold one. So... but that's cool. That one was good.
Hey, so, that's an awesome credit to have, though.
So, it was fun working with those guys.
Yeah.
Well, of course, at the beginning, I'd watched Star Trek with the original show with my dad when I was really young. And so I hadn't really seen much of the newer series. And so our manager calls him and goes, "You guys are Trekkies, right?" I go, "Well, no." She says, "You guys are Trekkies, right?" "Oh, yeah, of course. Yes, of course." So we immediately started watching all the Trek we could to get up to speed.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And it was really interesting because there was a whole technique in writing for Star Trek because the world of Trek is so laid out and so many things, it's got so much canon surrounding it. There was a science advisor on the show named Andre Bormanis. And so anytime there was something technical that was supposed to happen, you would just put the words "tech" in capital letters and brackets. And then he would fill in what that was in the Star Trek universe. So you would say, "Captain Janeway turns around and grabs the tech and turns it to..." The script would come back with the defibrillatorius defibrillator. Okay.
I don't know if that makes it easier or harder as a writer to do. I mean, it's easier in the fact that they've taken some of the burden off you, but it's harder in the fact that maybe that's an essential part of the story that you can't develop after that.
Right. Well, it makes it a little less fun. Like in one of the episodes, we did kick in a lot of the terms. We created something called a trajector. So we got by a lot of it, and it passed through. Except for we said the mantle had the planet had a mantle orthorhombic sulfur, and so we get a note back from Andre Bormanis saying, "I think it would be much more effective if the planet had a mantle of tetrahedral quartz." Okay, that was really one of the notes we got.
I guess that meant something in the Trek universe.
I guess so. So we said, "All right." I was happy that we got enough as many terms through as we did create. Yeah. It's a little more fun when you get to make stuff up.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, let's talk about Michael Perricone, the musician, now. So tell me about your Tibetan bowl music. How did that come about?
Well, the bowls, I was at a meditation. I've been into yoga and meditation for a long time. And I was at a meditation, and I noticed somebody was playing a bowl. And the frequency range of the bowl is such that it's at a point where the human ear... it's in the mid-range, and the human ear should be able to perceive direction very, very well. But it sounded like it was coming from all around me. So I was fascinated by what psychoacoustic event was taking place. So I came to it from a techie standpoint. So I'd go into the Bodhi Tree bookstore and play their bowls and say, "Well, how do I play this?" And pretty soon I got to realize, this feels really good just playing them. Mm-hmm. And I was communicating and finding out the history of it. I was communicating with these people called Bodhisattva Trading Company, thinking that they were in India or something, and they were in Culver City. So I'd go over there, and they'd get 300 bowls in, and I'd play maybe 100 of them, and then I might buy one of them. And it just grew, and the way that I felt playing them, and also the way people responded to them, and what they would say. I play a lot for yoga classes, and it's really grown into, my wife and I do workshops. And I'm playing at the Getty Center on May 20th with, I'm doing bowls. It's a trio, Tibetan singing bowls, Egyptian kawala flute, and Chinese zither. So we're going to be doing, that's going to be at the Getty Museum. It's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. That's awesome. I'd love to come, except I'm going to be in Alaska then.
Okay, well.
But another time, let me know, because I love that. That'd be great.
Okay.
Okay, so... there's a lot of interesting things happening with the bowls. Is it difficult to record? Because that's one thing I've never recorded, I have to say.
Well, I've now really, after 16 years of playing bowls, I've stumbled on a great way to record them, which is also what I do live as well. Because when I play at like the Hammer Museum, there might be 200 people there. We definitely have to put them through the speakers. And it's using ECM50 microphones, the Sony ECM50 lavalier mics.
The little lavs, yeah, right.
Yeah, and I just put a weight down on the mat around, because I lay my bowls out on a yoga mat. So I might be playing 30 or 40 of them, maybe 30 at a time, have them laid out. And I'll be playing various different, creating harmonics. And so I place the actual mics in between the bowls. And that has given me the best result, because believe me, I've tried condenser microphones, PZMs, dynamics. So I've just finally, by accident, settled on this. Actually, I was doing a video shoot and I didn't have anything. They were just going to use the boom mic. And the only thing I had handy was this lavalier mic. I just put it down and I was amazed. It gave me the best reproduction of any of the microphones I'd been using. After being a recording engineer for all these years, and I have old Neumann tube mics and everything, I settle on some old 1970s lavalier mic.
I didn't even know they made those anymore, do they? Or you just happen to have them?
So I picked them up. I had one that I just had for like ADR work and stuff like that. It was a backup to our more expensive Sanken lavalier mic. Mm-hmm. Since then, I've gone out and just on eBay picked up four or five more of them.
So you have 30 bowls, but you're only using five mics?
Yeah, so I just strategically placed them between the bowls.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I'm really only playing at any given moment three or four at a time. So
yeah, but you still have to cover them all.
Mm-hmm, right. So it gets plenty of decent coverage. And I play not all the bowls are of equal loudness. Some of the bowls just tend to be louder than the others. So it's knowing the bowls, knowing the set that I've had for so long, placing the microphones so I get a nice even pickup of the various different bowls.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Let's come back to post for a second. What's the most difficult thing for you when it comes to post, or the thing that you like the least in the whole process?
Oh, well, the thing that I like the least in the whole process is conforms. Because it's not as bad with the small independent films. Usually by the time they get to us, the picture is locked. But the bigger the film, the more conforms. They'll decide, okay, well, we're going to recut this film. And now we've taken 2 minutes out of reel one. Well, we've also taken something from reel three and put it in the middle of reel two. Oh. So now you've got all your tracks. You know, we've got 300 some odd tracks, and so you have to resync everything and make sense of all the transitions and everything. So it's a very technical and tedious task. It's the least creative part of the whole thing. So yes, that is the one aspect that I abhor. But it's the bigger the project, the more the conforms, the more they keep editing right till it's in the theaters.
Boy, it sounds like a nightmare. Let's talk about budgets for a second, because obviously when you're on a smaller budget, you don't have that luxury. But that being said, are you finding the budgets are stable? Are they going lower? Are they going higher in indies?
They've been plunging because it's a race to the bottom from a lot of, there are a lot of facilities who don't care, and they'll just bid whatever they can just to get the project. So budgets have been plunging. That's true. There are very few. The worst part is the mid-range has pretty much disappeared. The $100,000 sound budget feature has disappeared. Usually, it used to be for a $2 to $3 million feature, you'd get $100,000, $150,000 of a sound budget to do it, but not anymore. That's dropped down to the sometimes even as low as $35,000. I've had to turn down. We discovered we couldn't really do projects for less than about $35,000 or $40,000. Just you can't do a quality project because you have to pay, you can't pay the crew to do that,
mm-hmm.
and end up with a quality product. So yes, the budgets have plunged. It's had us become much more efficient. So there are some projects where I've only had 4 days to do a whole mix, and it's turned out really well. As a matter of, there are a couple on Netflix right now that I happen to catch part of one of them, and it really holds up well. So it's, you don't have time to think, you just kind of go. Another gear kicks in, and you're just mixing, you're just EQing fast, you're just going quick, and you just don't stop till you get to the end of the movie.
That's when you know when you're a pro, though, when you can do that and actually have it come out pretty good on the other side. There's that transition from when you're flailing to, well, I know where I'm going with this. And obviously, you know, you've hit that many, many years ago, but as a comparison, when things get tight time-wise and you just have to go and not really think, you know, you have to rely on your experience more than anything at that point.
Sure. The director then counts on you to be able to pace things. And that's where the one aspect of that really comes into play is knowing what to spend time on. That's where experience really comes in. And knowing that cleaning up this word in the long run is not going to make as much difference as if making sure that they can understand every word of this piece over here. So I'm just going to quickly EQ that a little bit and then move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's knowing which aspects to focus on and spend the time on, and which ones to just move quickly through.
Okay, last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you learned along the way, or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Best piece of business advice is not to try and keep up with technology at every moment and just and pace yourself as far as your technology expenditures, because it keeps moving fast, and if you're getting a good product, and just wait a little bit until the cash flow catches up before you buy the next piece of gear.
Boy, that's good. And I wish I would have followed that many times myself. It's really easy to get caught up in that game.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And you have to just take a breath and say, okay. A lot of times something might come up on eBay and I'd go, oh, that's a great deal. And that would really, well, okay, there'll be others.
Yeah.
There'll be another one later on. Okay.
Yeah.
This is not the time to do that.
To find out more about Michael the artist, you can go to jahnamusic.com. That's jahnamusic.com, all one word. And if you do a Google search of Michael Perricone, Perricone, you're going to find lots and lots of links and information and a full credit list, which will blow your mind. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.